Okay, well, we'll just get started here. Welcome, everyone, to our Sunday afternoon session. Full crowd today. Wonderful, thanks everyone for coming. For any of you who are new here, just to let you know that we have many things going on throughout the week. And be sure to pick up a schedule before you leave. Or go look at the schedule in the courtyard or on the website. I give talks here every Sunday at 3 p.m. and every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Except for the time I'm going to be away in Thailand and probably Sri Lanka as well for 2 months. So I'll be back in mid-December, hopefully, or late December. So today's talk, I thought I would go into... It's actually something that I've talked about before, and I'm pretty sure I've given a talk on Second Life about it. But... You know, it's important to go over the basics, and I'm sure there's a lot of people here who haven't heard me talk about this. And so the subject today is perception versus reality, which seems to me to be a very important topic in Buddhism and in Buddhist practice. And one of those things in life that is quite frightening, actually. It's quite frightening how wrong we can be about reality. And so it's something that always, I think, should have us second-guessing ourselves. We should never be so sure of ourselves that we don't allow for even the possibility of being wrong. Because it's impossible to tell sometimes based on your own perceptions whether those perceptions are right or wrong. If you don't really make effort to remove yourself from the situation and look at it objectively, It's very easy to be even 100% sure of yourself and turn out to be totally off base and out of touch with reality. This is obviously one of the most important concepts in Buddhism, our ignorance, our misunderstanding of reality. This is considered to be the root of all suffering. If you want to get right to the root, we generally say that the cause of suffering is craving. But where does craving come from? And if you follow it back to its source, all craving comes from delusion, from ignorance, from not knowing any better. Which is really a profound teaching, and I've often talked about ignorance, how profound this is, and how sometimes this is very different from our understanding of things. And I think very liberating as well, because if you take a person who's addicted to something, we often look at addiction from a point of view of brain chemistry, and so we say you can never really overcome an addiction, you can just work really hard to change to change the way you look at it, to change the way your brain works, or wait until the brain chemistry changes. And in Buddhism, that's not the case. The brain chemistry is one thing and the addiction is another. And or the physical addiction is one thing and the mental addiction is another. So your body and your brain can be addicted to something and you not have to strive to attain that thing because of the fact that that the root of our craving is our ignorance. And so the body being a slow-moving part of reality, slow to change, it often takes a while to catch up, but you don't have to go through that. We have to see the difference between the physical pleasure of something, of an addiction, and the mental volition or intention to follow that. And the understanding that it's beneficial to do so. If we can change those two things, the understanding, the misunderstanding of something, of a craving as being beneficial, and therefore the intention to follow after the physical cravings, then we can find ourselves in perfect happiness even without attaining the things that we desire. As an example of this, just talking about how our perception of things can be different from reality, or how we can immediately become free from an addiction. Someone asked me about a week ago about cigarettes. They were asking whether meditation could help them overcome cigarette addiction. And I said it's something that takes time. I mean, you have to get the understanding that you're not just going to do away with the physical craving. But what you can do in the beginning is, when you look closer at the craving, you'll see there are many layers to it. And the most external layer is generally guilt. The fact that someone would come and ask this means that they want to remove this addiction. So most likely they feel guilty about it. And that's what covers up most of our addiction, is our guilt about it. And this is one of the important ways that we misunderstand things. We grasp our bad habits wrongly, thinking that somehow we benefit from feeling guilty about them, from hating ourselves because of our imperfections. The other one is making excuses, and this generally goes hand in hand, because you can only hate yourself for so long before it becomes terribly painful. So the next step is usually making excuses or putting things off or so on. This rationalizing or finding a way of tricking ourselves into not dealing with the issue. So these have to go first, and you have to examine this. You have to stop feeling guilty, stop hating yourself, stop feeling bad about your cravings, your failings as a human being, and start to accept them as existing. Not accepting them as being good or being acceptable in terms of a cause of or a part of a harmonious existence. Obviously they're not. But accepting that they exist, not denying or ignoring them. And you find once you do that, that of course they disappear. And it's just this looking at things correctly, seeing things for what they are, that does away with whatever is the problem, or it neutralizes the poison. And once you're able to straighten that out, and that's really a very important straightening out of the mind, this giving up of guilt and trying to rationalize away things, but really accept the fact that you've got a problem, that there's something here, that there's work to be done. There is this reality, this is what's going on. Then you can look at the addiction itself. Only then you can look at the addiction. You can't come to honestly observe the addiction until you stop with this perverted mind state of feeling guilty and so on. And once you are able to look at the addiction objectively, you see that it's actually made up of several parts. And I've talked about this before as well. The craving is one thing, the wanting, or the sort of pull the attraction towards the object, say in this case cigarettes, is one thing. The feeling of pleasure is another thing. And the interesting thing about the feeling of pleasure is that it actually comes before you obtain the object of your desire. There's pleasure already there. And this is true with most addictions. I wouldn't say all addictions, and this is according to the theory. According to Buddhist psychological theory, Buddhist psychology, there are two kinds of craving. One kind of craving comes with a neutral feeling, and one kind of craving comes with a pleasant feeling. But for all intents and purposes, they're the same. They're both positive, and they're both seen as positive. It's seen that attaining something, for instance, sometimes smoking a cigarette doesn't bring pleasure, but it brings relief. So it's this calming state. And that comes at the moment when you want something, and that's what reminds us of what we're going to get. It reminds us of what's good about nicotine, or what's good about television, or what's good about music, or so on. Is when we want it, we've already got this starting up in the brain. The brain is already going through its cycle of addiction, or of providing pleasure. Because, you know, things like music or art or beauty can't directly provide us with happiness. There's no happiness that comes from light hitting your eye. I mean, that's not a very pleasant thing at all. There's a reaction going on in the eye that's actually quite chaotic. There's this light hitting the eye, bouncing off things, careening here and there and hitting your eye. Now, the pleasure comes when we interpret it in the brain. And the brain gives us this pleasure, dopamine, I believe. I've just been hearing things from scientists, and I like to drop names and words and stuff. But there's a chemical reaction that goes on. And you can see this through meditation. There's something going on that's bringing pleasure. Now, the neat thing is if you can separate these two, the craving from the pleasure, and focus alternately on either one or the other, then it's just as though you were untying a knot. And in fact, it's almost exact. That's what it feels like. It feels like you're untying a knot, something that looked totally unsolvable disappears. It looked like a real problem. You push and pull and twist and turn, and suddenly it's gone. And the neat thing is when you focus on, say, the pleasure, you can sit there and be happy. When you straighten your mind, and so, you know, according to the technique that I teach, you say to yourself, happy, happy, or pleased, pleased. Happy is probably the best. If it's just a calm feeling, you say calm, calm, calm. Focus on that. And when you're able to do that, you totally forget about the object. You've totally lost any interest in the object itself. You've penetrated to the heart of what's going on here, and you're seeing things clearly. This is an example of how it means that our perception of things, what is meant by the fact that our perception of things is sometimes radically different from the way things are. The Buddha had one of the important characteristics of his teaching was that he would categorize things. And this was in order to give a comprehensive understanding of things, to something that's easy to remember, and gives you a framework to work with that's complete. So, you know, what I just talked about is obviously just one aspect of suffering, of what causes us depression, what causes us frustration and anger and sadness and suffering and fear and so on. So this is, for example, why the Buddha taught the four foundations of mindfulness. Because when I say acknowledging a happy feeling, well, that's a useful technique, and I'd imagine that some of you would be able to put that into practice, but it's not comprehensive. So when the Buddha taught, he would he would give a total outline of things. And once you can remember these things and understand them, then you have a comprehensive framework in which to practice. So this idea of saying happy, happy, happy to yourself fits in with that framework, and it can actually apply to everything, to every aspect of your existence. Once you see your experiences as they are, once you understand them for what's going on at that moment and break it down into its component parts, into what's really happening, then you can be free from all of the knots, all of the tangles that exist in our mind. All of these problems that we have, instead of being seen as entities, they become simply knots. It's something that's perfect, that's just been tied up into knots, and that's why it looks imperfect. That's why it seems to be flawed, and in fact, it's just knots. And when you can untie those, you're free. So the four foundations of mindfulness are just a way of describing reality, breaking reality up into parts, to make it easier for you to do this. And one important quality of the four foundations of mindfulness is that it fits in with another classification, which the Lord Buddha called the perversions of perception. Our misunderstanding of things can be broken up into four parts. So that's sort of the framework of this talk today, that I'd just like to go over these four things. So first of all, the four foundations of mindfulness, if you're not aware, I talk about them a little bit in my videos, but don't go into great detail. It's breaking up reality and breaking down the meditation practice into easily practicable parts, starting with the body. So the first foundation is the body, or the first way we can establish mindfulness is based on the body. When we watch the breath, and our technique is to encourage people to watch the stomach rising, because that's part of the body. If you've never practiced meditation before, it might not be the easiest object. But I guarantee once you get into meditation, once you start practicing it and start to calm down, once your body starts to relax, because your mind is no longer stressing and clinging to everything, you'll find this is by far the most obvious part of the body when you're sitting still. So we have people watch this, and if in the beginning it's when it's still not clear or obvious, you can put your hand on your stomach just to reassure yourself that it is actually rising and falling. When the breath goes into the body, the stomach should rise. When the breath goes out of the body, the stomach should fall. This is natural. If it's not doing that, which it doesn't for many people, then there's something wrong with the state of your body, which is common. I mean, again, we shouldn't feel bad about this, but this is the state of things. Nowadays, we're so stressed out that our bodies are incredibly tense. You can try, if you want, lying on your back. Put your hand on your stomach, lying on your back, and then watch it, just to confirm for yourself that in a natural state, that's what happens. And that's sometimes useful to show us how tense we are when we sit up, when we're ready to go, when we're in work mode. Our whole body tenses up and we're not able to see this. But that's one example of how to be mindful of the body. When the belly rises, just say to yourself, rising. The belly falls, falling. Rising, falling. And this is just an example. It's a beginner's technique. It's one that we always go back to. It's something that trains the mind in this technique, allowing you to apply it then to every part of experience, allowing you to see things, see everything that you experience clearly. It's like sharpening your knife or sharpening your sword so that you can then use it in battle. When you're sharpening it, or when you're training in some kind of sport or some kind of martial art, when you train, you know, it doesn't seem like you're getting anything, but what you're doing is training your body, and in this case, training your mind. The other thing that I've always said about watching the breath that is sometimes not well understood is that the secret really is that it doesn't matter what you acknowledge. You know, we might think, watching the breath is a silly thing because it doesn't have anything to do with my problems. You know, here I am depressed over this, stressed about that, angry, frustrated, and so on. It has nothing to do with the breath. But the truth is that whatever applies to one part of our existence also applies to every other part of our experience. If we get stressed over one thing, then that doesn't mean that that object or something wrong with it. What it means is that we have a wrong way of looking at things. So if you just watched your breath rising and falling for days on end, you'd be able to learn so much about yourself. In fact, you could learn everything. You can become enlightened just watching the rising and the falling. Unfortunately, it's not that easy, because our mind doesn't let us stay with the rising and falling. And so the Buddha, you know, had many other objects for us to acknowledge. For instance, pain, or in general sensations in the body. It could be a happy sensation, a pleasurable sensation, or a state of calm or equanimity. And when these come up, you just focus on them, pain, or happy, happy, calm, until they go away. It doesn't matter what you're focusing on, so you can forget about the rising and falling, just focus on the pain, because it's clearer. At that point, when it arises, it generally takes your attention away from the rising and falling. So, not a problem, focus on it instead. And this is incredibly useful, because it allows us to overcome our misunderstandings about pain. And instead of thinking it as a bad thing, we see it as simply pain. The third one is our thoughts, acknowledging any kind of thinking that arises about thinking about the past or future, when our mind starts to wander. Because obviously in the beginning your mind is not going to be with the rising and falling most of the time. Most of the time it's going to be thinking about so many different things. And when that happens, we just focus on the thinking instead and say to ourselves, thinking. And the fourth category is actually more like a bunch of tools for us during the time that we're practicing. It's not any particular categorization of reality, but it's lists of tools or of techniques in the meditation. The first one being the meditation on the five hindrances. And this can be expanded to refer to all of our emotions, which are indeed a specific part of reality. Another one is the six senses, so seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking. And when these come up, we can acknowledge them as well. So the five hindrances, these are all emotions which take us out of a clear awareness of reality, liking, disliking, and by extension, anger, sadness, frustration, boredom, fear. We feel drowsy or tired, distracted, when we feel confused or worried or doubting, acknowledging these as well, liking or disliking and so on. So for many of you, this is already old news. You've heard this on my videos or from the talks or maybe from studying from other Buddhist teachers. What I'd like to talk about today then is how these help us to overcome the specific types of misunderstanding of reality. The first misunderstanding of reality that the Buddha talked about is the misunderstanding of beauty, of attraction, and in specific attraction to the body, to the human body. Because it's arguably the greatest attraction or the most primal attraction for human beings to be attracted to a specific type of human body and to be turned off by another type of body. When we look at someone's face, to be attracted to it or to be turned off. When we look at different parts of people's body, to be attracted by the human body. And so this is how they fit in nicely with the four foundations of mindfulness, because this one is obviously countered by examining the body. As you watch and start to see the true nature of the body, then this partiality disappears. We come to... See, Buddhism is... This is what I mean by saying taking us out of our perceptions and coming to see reality. Our perception of reality is so narrow. I don't think there's anybody here, or I hope there's nobody here, who looks at these deer and finds them sexually attractive. I know there are certain, apparently, people who find this, but it's certainly not a very widespread emotion. And yet the deer would say the same about us. They don't find any of us attractive. I know apparently with dogs it can be different, but this is an example of how narrow our understanding of reality is. And we've built up this perception, and in fact views based on our perceptions, that this is natural, that this is the way things should be. We think of this as reality, and all what I'm trying to offer is that, given the fact that reality is such a much broader broader thing, we're severely limiting ourselves and suffering from intense partiality. And as a result of this partiality, we fall again and again into dissatisfaction and suffering. The truth about reality is that the human state is not anything particularly special. That in fact it's a very contrived state. It's something that has evolved over time, on both a physical and a mental level, from our constant reproduction and cultivating of this state. When in fact, from a Buddhist point of view, the whole of the universe has to be taken into consideration. You know, the constellations and the galaxies and the whole of the universe is really a part of reality. We're not limited to this very incredibly narrow state of the human existence, which is a brief moment in time. And this is part of the theory. I'm just trying to say this because for me it's easy to understand, having studied, but I know for many people beauty is something so important to people. You know, appreciating a tree or a sunset or something, this is important to people. But from a point of view of the whole broad perspective of reality, it's just a human emotion, our attraction to these things. And what's higher than that, and what's more pleasant than that, more satisfying than that, is impartiality. And they say, like sitting on a mountain enjoying the sunset is one thing, but when the self disappears, and when there is no one sitting on the mountain, and it's just the reality of it, when the self disappears, when we're able to let go of our attachment to one part of reality, then we reach a higher state. It's very difficult to understand, and I think many people are turned off from Buddhist practice because of this sort of thing, which is understandable. given the very steep inclination of people towards sensuality. But once you focus, once you look at reality, I mean, I'm not trying to indoctrinate anybody by any means. Once you look at reality, this is what I mean, is that you'll come to see that our perception of things is often very different from the way they are. If it turns out that reality is not the way I say it is, then by all means, share it with me. I'm happy to learn something. But having investigated reality, it's pretty clear that there's more to life than this sort of thing. Okay. And not clear to those who don't practice. So this is the first one. The second one is the misperception of happiness, that certain pleasurable experiences are true happiness. The true happiness can be found from pleasurable sensations. It's equally difficult to understand. We consider that's the meaning of happiness, is a pleasurable sensation. And if you don't practice meditation, you therefore find it very difficult to understand why we suffer. You have a difficult time. We have a difficult time understanding, especially with all of the pleasure around us. And in fact, more true, the more pleasure we have around us, that we fall into suffering when we're not presented with, or even we can be presented with happiness, with happy states, and still be incredibly depressed and unhappy. Especially when you hear someone telling you how the body's really not beautiful after all, and so on and so on. This is displeasing. But it's something, it's very difficult actually, because we look at people who appear to have it all and they seem so happy, right? They even pretend to be very happy. It's very misleading. It's not true. You know, look at movie stars, for example, who seem to have it all, who seem to be on top of the world. And we all know that they're terribly miserable. Suicide and drug abuse runs rampant among these people who are seemingly at the height of sensuality. And then you have these old guys sitting on the top of a mountain eating stale rice and living in a cave, who are immensely happy and at peace. And this is because pleasant feelings are not the be-all, end-all of happiness. They are a part of the cycle of addiction. I'm not making this up, and I'm not trying to repress. I mean, there's always this knee-jerk reaction by people, oh, this is some purist telling us to repress these feelings. And it's shocking on the one hand, but it's also predictable that people should react like this. Because, as I said, we're incredibly steeped in this notion that this is... I mean, look around you. Look at the world around you. What do you get in the mail every day? Everyone's trying to convince you. Your parents try to convince you. Your friends try to convince you. The television tries to convince you. Second Life does a pretty good job of convincing you that this is where happiness lies. And yet it doesn't. In this lies only depression and dissatisfaction. And the more free you can be from this, the happier you are. So acknowledging the feelings and seeing them change allows you to be free from both sides, so that you're at peace with yourself, so that your happiness doesn't come from emotions. The happiness that you have is this sense of freedom, not being bound, not being afflicted by this constant bombardment of craving and needing and not getting what you want. The third misperception is that of permanence. And this has to do with our concept of stability, that this state is sustainable, and it could be any state in particular. We fall into this. This is outside of the first two. This sort of misperception has to do with, for instance, our relationships with other people, and why people will mourn the loss of a loved one for a long time, and might even do something drastic if they lose a loved one or someone breaks up with them. When things change, this inability to understand that everything is impermanent. The reason why we cling to things is this misunderstanding. The reason why we go for pleasurable feelings in the first place and think of them as pleasant is because we have some idea that it's going to last long enough to satisfy us. This one is also very difficult. We think that our relationships are very important to us. Our relationships are a cause of pleasure, and often they are, when they last. But it's just really one example, and it's not the whole of our life. We're constantly being denied this permanence, this stability. And yet we don't get it, we don't see it. And this is why, as an example, when someone dies, we suffer incredibly. Because it was an important part of our life. This was something we depended upon. We relied upon the existence of this reality. But it's happening all the time. When something breaks, when we get sick, when we're interrupted in the middle of a television program or a song or so on, when things change, when our pleasure, our happiness disappears. The practice of meditation, this is one of the three profound realizations that come, this idea of impermanence, and it's very fundamental to Buddhism. It's very fundamental to much Buddhist or much religious practice from all around the world, this idea of impermanence, that things don't last, that the things that we cling to are ephemeral, that we have a very narrow scope of view in regards to the whole of reality, that the idea that the human life, we've got many years to live or so on, is actually so fundamentally flawed that we have very limited time on this earth. And it's very unstable. We don't know when we're going to die. But even if we do live out the full course of our life, it's very short. And that's a scary thing, because we don't know where we're going. From a Buddhist point of view, when you study, when you practice meditation, when you actually put into practice these teachings of what, looking and learning about reality, it makes perfect sense, this idea of rebirth. It comes to be clear that this is what's going to happen. You can feel it. You don't have to justify it or intellectualize it in any way. That's what's going to happen when you die. You're going to be, left without a refuge, without anything to hold on to. And this is why, when beings die, they cling to anything, whatever comes up. And this is why, when you're about to die, everything starts to flash before your eyes, because your mind starts to panic, starts to release itself. And if you really do die, it's going to cling to one of those memories as a replacement, and when the physical reality of this life disappears, it's going to go with that. if your mind is not trained, this clinging can be incredibly fierce, and it's like roulette. You don't know what you're going to cling to. Well, you can actually tell with some certainty based on your states of mind, and the sorts of things that you cling to now are going to be the sorts of things that you cling to when you die. If you're a very angry person, you're probably going to cling to some sort of anger or fear or so on, a negative emotion. If you're a very addicted sort of person, lustful, craving sort of person, then you cling to something pleasurable. You cling to something base and pleasure and, you know, immediately satisfying. And you'll fall into that. So you might be born as a dog or a goat, or even born in an unpleasant state based on your state of attachment. When we practice meditation, we come to realize this impermanence. We see that really we're our whole life is unstable. Our whole existence is unstable because it's dependent on the mind. And this is how this fits in with the four foundations of mindfulness, because mindfulness of the mind is what allows you to really see impermanence. You can see that even our mind states, which is the most fundamental building block of reality, what allows us to experience things, even it is not permanent. It's not one mind lasting. It's mind state after mind state after mind state, and they can be totally unconnected at times. You find you're thinking about one thing one moment, and suddenly you're off on a tangent and you don't know how you got there. Suddenly something completely unrelated comes up. And it can be based on a memory, it can be based on a sound, but the mind arises based on these various causes. It can be totally unrelated. You see that all of our experience is totally dependent on the mind. What you're seeing here in front of you doesn't actually exist in an experiential way until the mind picks it up. For instance, someone can be saying things to you, can be talking to you, but you don't hear them unless your mind is at the ear. So sometimes you might be intent on the computer and someone's talking to you and you never heard a word they said. You honestly didn't hear it because your mind wasn't there. So what this does is allows us a more dynamic approach to reality. We're able to take change a lot better. We're able to take loss much better. We're able to see that it does us no good wishing for things or wanting for things or hoping for things to remain the way they are, to never change, or to attach to things, to objects as permanent, when we know that they're going to disappear. We start to lose this naturally. It's not an intellectual thing. Acknowledge to yourself thinking, or acknowledging all of the objects, all of the four foundations of mindfulness, gives you a much more dynamic outlook on life. So you're able to roll with the punches. When things change, you don't take it the wrong way. You understand what was subject to change has changed. And that's it. It's this understanding that allows you to... you're not repressing any attachment or love for people. You have a clear understanding that this is the way it really is. Any sadness or despair or suffering would simply be based on a invalid expectation of things, which is against the way things really are. So this is the third misperception. The fourth one is the misperception of self, the idea that we're in control. And this is an interesting one, because I wouldn't want to say that we are deterministic beings, that we are fated to some destiny or other, because I don't think this is a valid way of looking at reality. It's a fatalistic self-defeating. Because obviously if things are determined, then you don't have to do anything. And by thinking that, you change right away your future. So from an internal perspective, we are very much in control of our future. It's just that we're not in control in the ways that we think we are. And this has a lot to do with impermanence and the reason why things are unsatisfying, because we can't control them. We can't stop things from changing. What we are, in a sense, in control of is how we react to it and the direction we turn in. This is really at the core of our misunderstanding of things, is this idea that we're in control. And this approaching of everything in terms of how to control, how to be in charge, how to get what we want, how to arrange our lives in such a way as so that we never suffer, which of course is impossible. So we always arrive at some sort of a near approximation, best approximation to total control, thinking that we've somehow arranged things in such a way that we're more or less stable, more or less happy. And from a human point of view, this seems reasonable. You know, if I can be stable for the next, 40, 50 years, then wow, that's, I've lived a good life. And of course, it's not always even possible to do that. It's a gamble, right? You can say that, but many people have said that and failed. Nowadays in America, it's most people, or a great majority of people, have, who thought they were very stable, have seen their futures pulled out from underneath them and have found themselves in great distress unexpectedly, thinking that they had set up their lives in such a way that it was stable. They tried to control things, and when it changed, generally fall into great despair, because it's not, directly because of their all the work that they did to set things up in that way. And again, this is from a human point of view, it seems reasonable to do that. That's what we're taught to do, to set up our lives. And to some extent, it's unavoidable. If you don't do that, you will fall into great trouble. But it's this expectation and this idea that somehow we can control things. That's quite different from doing things out of necessity, knowing that if I don't do this, I'm going to be out on the street, or I'm going to, doing it as a matter of course. And because doing it as a matter of course, you can be totally aware that this is my attempt to do things, and I don't know whether it's going to work or not, but it's really the only way to go at this point, doing things according to what is appropriate, as opposed to trying to set up and control things. The more universalistic, if you will, universalist way of approaching things, like when we look at things from a much broader, from a point of view of the nature of reality, we're trying to move closer to a point of not controlling things, of not being in charge, of not trying to create something, to build ourselves up to be something. Our goal in Buddhism, and in that sense, it's why Buddhism is so compatible to any lifestyle, any culture, any society, is because it doesn't aim to be anything in particular. It aims to help us let go of those things that we already are, and to attain this state of bare attention and simple, clear understanding of things as they are. And so this final one is particularly achieved through acknowledgement of our emotions, our attachment to things, how we like certain things and dislike certain things, when we focus on the emotions, we're best able to do away with this, to change our idea of of self. If you zoom in on me, you have a better chance of hearing me. If you can figure out how to zoom in on my character, because sometimes your setting is such that you can't hear. Anyway, I'm almost done, and then we'll switch to text. So, focusing on, say, the emotions, focusing on the six senses, but really focusing on all aspects of reality. You're able to break it up into experience by experience by experience. And you're able to do away with this clinging, with this need to control things. When we focus on reality, I think another good one is the six senses, because it helps us to break reality up into pieces and helps us to see that what we thought was ourself, this being that's in control, is actually just a conglomerate of experiences. So this is the fourth misunderstanding, and these four are incredibly challenging. And I think for a beginner in Buddhism, it's this is the challenge that is presented to us. And the answer is not to accept these things blindly, but to take this challenge. And if you can deny this, if you can, through proper and extended introspection, can prove me wrong, that can prove these teachings wrong, then that's no problem. That's the way to go about it. And that's the scientific way to approach this, is to take it as a theory and to test it. And this is what we've done. We're not preaching or pushing anything on people. This is an expression of reality. Now, the problem is reality is an incredibly broad thing, and we're incredibly far removed from it. That's why it's generally repugnant and unacceptable to most people. So rather than just dismiss it and say, this is stupid, I already know the truth, you know, I already know that these things are bringing me happiness and pleasure and satisfaction and permanence and so on. You know, ask yourself, are you happy all the time? And it's a very difficult thing to do, to actually open up to the fact that you might be wrong. I was teaching in the jail, and this man, I think I talked about this before, one of the inmates, he was the worst of them all, and he was always talking when they were doing walking meditation, and I couldn't get him to shut up and just watch his feet. And so he came, and you know, I had to do these interviews one-on-one and talking to him. He came over on his own, and he said, you know, I really don't get it, and I, you know, I wonder if you have some books, maybe I can study. And so I started asking him. I said, well, you know, don't you ever get angry? No. Don't you ever, you know, get frustrated or sad or depressed? No, never. I'm like, wow. You know, then your life must just be total happiness. And he said, well, you know, I do get angry, but everybody gets angry, right? I mean, we have this, we're unable to look at these things. We don't want to accept them. We are trying to desperately to convince ourselves that everything's all right. And it generally becomes, everything would be all right if I could just get this. So these guys are obsessed with, when I get out of here, everything's going to be fine. Everything's going to be perfect. You know, all I need to do is get out of here and I'm set. You know, that's the problem. But it's so not. There's another guy in jail. He's a yoga practitioner, meditates every morning. And he says, you know, this is great. I've got a private retreat for the next, he's in for 4 years more. And he said, when I get out of here, I'm just going to go find a monastery and keep meditating. So this is the challenge. And I guess the other thing that's worth saying is you don't have to accept it completely, and you don't have to understand these teachings completely. It's useful to get an understanding that this potentially is the truth, and you know, accept the fact that we're not going to, in this lifetime, maybe be able to realize this truth completely, but we can work at it. And it's a challenge for us to expand our horizons and to look at things in a different way, to not blindly accept the fact that our attachment to things are the right way, and our love of beauty and so on is right already. Love of music is a good thing, and so on. To listen to music, fine. Enjoy beauty, fine. But at the same time, understand that this very well could be a limited understanding of reality, and once we're able to accept things on a broader scale, everything is music, everything is beauty, and there is no differentiation between certain states as more or less pleasant, and because our happiness, our state of pleasure, so to speak, doesn't depend on any state. Okay, I'm going to stop there. That was almost an hour. I'd like to thank you all for coming. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I hope that this teaching has been of benefit to all of you, and I hope that you're able to put these teachings and the rest of the Buddhist teaching into practice for your progress on the path and for the eventual realization of true peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering. Thank you for coming.